All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. As I did last week, I'll begin the show with words people need to think about and act on. Women are not incubators or breeders. Women are not the property of men. Women are full human beings. This week again, we will be talking about the right to abortion, a fundamental human right, and a right that is under fascist assault. The fascists in various states are no longer simply trying to put up barriers to abortion. They are outright criminalizing abortion and the heroic healthcare providers who perform abortions. And there's a fascist regime ruling the U.S. The courts have been stacked with Nazi judges who are openly hostile to the rights of women, LGBTQ people, immigrants, and people of color. The Supreme Court is stacked with Christian fascists. In the face of laws that endanger the lives and futures of hundreds of millions of women in the U.S. alone, that threaten a literal Handmaid's Tale future, very, very few people are acting to stop it. Way too many people who say that they are pro-choice echo the poisonous words of ruling-class Democratic politicians that abortion should be rare, that it's a difficult or even tragic choice, pushing the harmful shame and stigma that harms real women seeking fundamental health care. All throughout the South and in other parts of the country, abortion providers are facing life and death circumstances, and it's up to us to stand with them all the way. So, at the back end of the show, we'll replay part of an interview I did a couple of years ago with Dr. Willie Parker. Dr. Parker, an abortion provider in Mississippi and Alabama, two of the places where the attack on abortion rights are very, very heavy, wrote a book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. He is an outspoken Christian reproductive justice advocate who pulls from his personal and professional journeys, as well as the scientific training he received as a doctor, to reveal how he came to believe unequivocally that helping women in need without judgment is precisely the Christian thing to do. Links to the full interview with Dr. Parker can be found on my Facebook page and the website, themichaelslateshow.com. To start the show off, as I said last week, we would try to bring you other powerful voices for the emancipation of women and all humanity.
And I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show someone who has spoken about this a lot on our show and in general, and she's just written a piece in on revcom.us. Her name is Sansara Taylor. And, you know, look, right now, just for people as we move into this, right now there's a wave of reactionary laws that have ripped away women's rights to control their own bodies. It's an incredibly dangerous time. There's just a boatload of states that are, you know, declaring abortion illegal, declaring them illegal after a certain period of time, a very tiny period of time, all this stuff. And everything that they're doing is to take away the humanity of women. And Sansara Taylor has been out there standing up against this, exposing what's going on. She had a recent article on RevCom, and let's just, I'll tell you who she is actually first. For those people who don't know, Sansara initiated the Abortion Rights Freedom Rides held in 2013 and 2014, and she's now part of the National Revolution Tour going around the country, spreading revolution and organizing people into the movement for an actual revolution. So with all that having been said, Sansara, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's really good to be with you. Thank you.
Sure. Let's jump into this. We have a googobs of time, actually, at this point, probably about 20.
Oh, googobs. I like
yeah.
that.
There you go. 25 minutes, maybe
googobs
20 minutes.
Googobs is much more substantive than the little goo that they're trying to enshrine with personhood rights right now, the little goo of a fertilized embryo.
Very good. I'll have to remember that.
Googobs. All right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So for people who don't know, there is, as you put it, you have a recent article at revcom.us, as I was referring to. And as you put it in that article, you said that there is a very vicious wave of anti-abortion legislation that's being hammered into law across the country. And I wanted you to speak to that a little bit first, because a lot of times this stuff goes right over people's heads. They don't really get, you know, if you see it, it's happening in these southern states, it's happening over here, it's happening there, it's happening there. But they don't. A lot of times people just don't see that it's not just the trend, but there's actually a solidification of a very terrible thing in terms of what's going on in society at large.
Yeah, we are facing an extraordinary escalation in what has been an all-out war on women's ability to decide for themselves when and whether to have a child. And I think the most extreme, but hardly the, you know, hardly unique law that was recently passed is in Alabama, where the state passed a law that would criminalize all abortions in all circumstances, even rape and incest, with the very, very narrow exception of if a woman's life or major health is endangered. Of course, that's a subjective, as we've seen around the world. I'll come back to that. That's been a very subjective and hard-fought question of how, what constitutes an exception, how certain do you need to be. But basically, they're making it so that every abortion is criminal. Every, and along with that, miscarriages are suspect, and stillborn births are suspect, and women who don't live up to somebody's standard of how they should take care of themselves during a pregnancy could be criminalized. And in this Alabama law, doctors who perform abortions or anybody who assists a woman with an abortion would face 99 years in prison. I mean, a life sentence in this system's prisons and dungeons. And I think this is really, you know, there's laws in that have been passed recently in Utah, in Georgia. Georgia's criminalizing abortion at 6 weeks, which is way before most women even realize they're pregnant. And that's a law that's written in a way explicitly that would open women up to prosecution for murder. And Ohio, Mississippi, Kentucky, Arkansas, Indiana, all across this country, there's actually been laws that have been signed into place that restrict abortion in very extreme ways, many of them in ways that go beyond what's legally allowed under currently standing federal law. And the purpose of these is twofold. One, to actually really restrict and condemn and set in place restrictions that will stop women from getting abortions in those places. But two, explicitly to challenge the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in 1973 and to overturn this. And the goal overall, I think, was really well put by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who has been fighting for people to understand why this has been such a huge flashpoint in the culture and in society and in the law for decades. And he said, unbelievable as it may seem, there are people in this century who are determined to force women to bear children, regardless of the situation, the feelings, and the better judgment of those women themselves. And this is a way of enslaving women to the dictates of an oppressive, male supremacist, patriarchal system. And that is what the cruel fanatics who are determined to deny women the right to abortion are really about. And I think when Bob Avakian says this, he's putting in focus what has been driving these laws, the assault on abortion providers, the fact that 11 people have been assassinated by anti-abortion fanatics, the fact that clinics have been blown up around the country, the fact that all over this country, women who go into abortion clinics in every part of the country, not just in the deep South, in the deep North as well, in places, the quote-unquote liberal bastions like San Francisco and New York, you have to walk a gauntlet of harassment and vitriol and woman-hating and shame. And all of this is a really, really deep reaction against the idea that women should be anything other than breeders of children. Really, their highest duty and command is to bear children, to nurture children, to be a helpmeet to men. And this is a movement that is determined to drag women back to that. And I think it's really important to recognize that already across this country, even before these laws, in huge parts of this country, women are already having their lives foreclosed by forced motherhood. There are 7 states with only 1 abortion clinic left. The obstacle of hundreds of miles of travel, of arbitrary, medically unnecessary, and punitive mandatory waiting periods. So if you make the 100-mile trip from one part of Mississippi to the one clinic that's there, you then have to wait and come back for another visit. And that clinic, because the doctors are so endangered and because of the extreme limitations, only is open 3 days a week. I mean, it's open every day, but it only does abortions 3 days a week. So you have to schedule it on one of those days, and you have to make the trip again. And then if you don't get there before 16 weeks to make both your trips and all of this, the clinic can't do an abortion after 16 weeks. You have to go to another state and start the process over again. This is already the circumstance for huge numbers of women and girls in this country, along with the fact that women are being sent to prison for miscarriages or for self-inducing abortions. This is happening already. This is happening already. And people need to understand the aim of this drive to criminalize abortion, to revoke the right to abortion, is not even just to take us back to the days before Roe v. Wade, as barbaric as that was, as many women died, bled to death in back alleys and motel rooms after botched illegal abortions. Thousands of women died that way, or from sepsis infections in emergency rooms where they were treated, you know, sometimes kindly by doctors, but many times with a great deal of coldness and shame. Even in addition to all the deaths, all the unnecessary suffering, all the unnecessary shame and isolation, and all the women whose lives were foreclosed by forced motherhood before Roe v. Wade, what we're facing, we have to understand, is a situation where they are enshrining, like I was joking at the top of the show, they are enshrining a fertilized egg with the full rights of a person. This is what they're driving at, which means that at the second of conception, a woman becomes a vessel legally, and that entity within her, which is actually not a person, it's a subordinate part of a woman's body, that is elevated to the status of personhood rights. And anybody who does harm to that, including the woman who is a full thinking, breathing human being with history, social relations, and dreams of the future, is subjugated to that state protected thing growing within her. And if she chooses to terminate, she could be charged with murder. If somebody assists her in that, they could be charged with murder and sent to prison. And we're in, you know, the other thing that's changed since Roe v. Wade is we're in a situation where privacy barely exists anymore. The idea that you could somehow obscure what happens to your intimate life, to your health, that you could have privacy in that realm without the state intruding. I mean, that's something that people should fight for, but it's very restricted. And we're in an age of mass incarceration, of incredible criminalization. So you have sort of this high-tech surveillance state, you have a mass incarceration society, and you have a movement which now, with the Supreme Court having been remade by Trump and packed with Christian fascists, you have these lawmakers, these fanatical anti-woman, dark ages, fundamentalist lawmakers across the country who are explicitly trying to enshrine personhood status to fertilized eggs and embryos and fetuses, and slam women backwards to be nothing more than breeders of children. And they're anticipating and fighting for this to make it up to the Supreme Court and become the law of the land. And whether they win it outright right now in one of these cases that was passed this year, or whether it is chipped away at and chipped away at the way it's been, already we're in a extreme emergency, and people have got to wake up. It's not a Mississippi thing. It's not an Alabama thing. It's the future of women everywhere if this is not stopped. And people have to come forward in a massive way, out in the streets, with an outpouring of rage and determination on a level that we have not seen probably ever in this country. Because this really is about the enslavement of half of humanity, and it affects every woman and every girl in this country, and it has implications for the whole world. This is not a joke. This is not a test. This is not a pendulum swing. This is, just to pull the lens back, I know I've been speaking at length, but just to pull the lens back on one more point. The idea that women are full human beings and not mere property of men, the idea that women are not mere breeders of children, the idea that women should participate fully and equally in society is historically a very, very young idea. Historically, we've lived through thousands of years of patriarchy. If you pull back the lens further, most of human history was not patriarchal, but we've lived thousands of years under patriarchy and enslavement of women. And the idea that women are full human beings has been around 100 years or so. It's become practiced through ferocious struggle in the last 50 years or so for huge numbers of women. That is a very new idea. It's very fragile. And what we are looking at with these laws criminalizing abortion in this country is part of a wave around the world that is actually taking aim at that notion that women are full human beings, rising fascism, rising fundamentalism. And we could talk more about that as well. But this is not a pendulum swing. This is very, very deadly serious. And it is very far along. And people have to confront it for what it is and respond to it as such.
Yeah. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper, and one of the participants in the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. And we're talking about the fascist assault on abortion.
I think that's really important, and that's actually where I wanted to go. It's this whole point about, you know, look, what you were just speaking to, a violent reassertion of patriarchal enslavement and all the consequences of that. This is actually, you know, it's something that people, I don't know, you can't ignore what's going on, but you also have to understand the depth of it and the intensity of this. And you've called it out for what it is, a fascist movement rooted in an unreformable patriarchal system, which is actually has consequences for women and for actually for everyone in the society. You know, it's not just a woman thing. It's a fight for everyone who wants justice and equality. Too few men are involved in this fight, to be honest. And I think that actually looking at this and understanding what is the character of what's actually being done and carried out now. And, you know, it's spreading around the world, but the U.S. is certainly at the forefront of this.
Yeah, I think people need to really think about what a major decision it is to bring a child into the world, how life-changing it is. I mean, everything about who you are in the world, what you're able to do. If you want to have a child, it can be one of the most beautiful things, especially if you're able to do it in the way that you want and you have the resources and support around you. It's a beautiful thing. But if you don't want to have a child and you are forced to against your will and you're shamed into it, you are threatened into it, all of that, and you're forced to against your will, it is akin to rape. It is a forceful control over your body, over your life, over your intimate sphere, over your future by a patriarchal society. And I think that, you know, it shapes everything. It really shapes everything. And this is what they're after. And I think, you know, just to speak to this point of a patriarchal system, we have lived in a patriarchy. You know, patriarchy has been woven into different forms of class divided society for thousands of years. It's been woven into, I mean, it didn't get created with capitalism. Capitalism that we live under now, capitalism, imperialism, inherited patriarchy from previous class-divided societies, but it's woven into this society. It's very woven into it. It's woven into the economy. It's woven into the culture. It's woven into the social relations. And even though we've seen massive changes in the social position of women in the last 50 years, largely because of women's struggle, because women have stood up and they've demanded rights and they've fought against sexual discrimination and sexual assault and the shame over women's sexuality. They've stood up here and in different parts all over the world. And there's been, through that and a combination of major economic changes driven by this system of capitalism, imperialism, a lot of the effects of globalization, there have been huge changes in the economic status of women. Women have been pulled into the workforce, both through the struggle of women and through the economic changes driven by this system, have been pulled into the workforces from and education systems and all this stuff in this country and all over the world, from the sweatshops, which is incredibly exploitative in Bangladesh, but still a different social position of women, to the fact that women are in the professions in large parts of the world and demanding their rights. There's been huge changes. Patriarchy has not been ended. Traditional forms of patriarchy have been very strained, and abortion and birth control have been pivotal to this. You don't have women in public life. You don't have women in education. You don't have women in the professions if every pregnancy is, except those that naturally miscarriage, if every pregnancy is followed by a birth. Birth control and abortion underlay the ability for women to enter all these spheres. And so there's been huge changes, but patriarchy has not been ended. And it can't be, because it's woven into this system of capitalism, imperialism. And because of that, the reforms, even the reform of winning abortion, as monumental as that has been, was A, partial. It was always under attack. It was always partial. And B, it's now being gone after with a vengeance by fascist and fundamentalist movements that have been unleashed and given initiative because of the workings and the reassertion of the patriarchy through this system. And you see that, you know, just to stay in this country for a minute, you see that in a concentrated way with this Trump-Pence regime, which is a violent reassertion of the most vicious patriarchy, as well as a violent reassertion of the white supremacy that's also rooted in this system, going back to slavery, but never having been uprooted. You see the violent reassertion of manifest destiny, America first, the American imperial project, you see all of this, the vicious xenophobia. You see all this being reasserted with a vengeance, because while a lot of these oppressive divisions, especially the patriarchy, but also white supremacy, other things were challenged and deeply struggled against in the 60s and since, they are rooted in this system. And unless and until that system is overthrown, they can't be unwoven. And there's a reason why there's a revengeist reassertion of them. And that's what we're facing now. And fundamentally, it poses two things. It poses the need to get rid of a system like that, to overthrow a system like that. We have had, you know, in the 60s was a huge project, a huge experiment in whether this system could be reformed. And many reforms were won, and every single one of them is being gone after right now. And the people are going to pay the price if this system is not overthrown, if people don't get organized, which is why I'm part of the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. And it's very germane to this question of whether women will be treated as full human beings or reduced to breeders of children. We have to actually get organized to build a movement that is preparing the ground and taking up and influencing millions for the time when this system, when millions can be led to fight all out to overthrow this system, bring it down and bring a different system into being. And two, it poses the need, even as part of building for that, and even for people who are not convinced of the need for an all-out revolution, to get out in the streets and wage massive resistance against this assault on abortion. And by that, I do not mean voting for the Democrats. I do not mean campaigning for 2020. And we have to talk very, I think we should talk about the profound danger of people getting played in that way again, of relying on the Democrats to protect these rights and rallying through the elections to protect these rights, which has been a loser. It has actually been part of the problem, and it's part of how we got into such a dangerous position.
Let's actually jump into that, because we're going to have about maybe 8 minutes left here. So let's jump into that. I think it's really important, because there's, you know, these big questions that are confronting people right now, that, and people, some people, they just don't understand where the hell it comes from. You know, this idea that Democrats, this is incredible when you're hearing people talk about the Democrats are going to step up and save the right to abortion, or they're going to save, you know, they're going to stop this. They're going to stand in the way of the assault on women that's coming down from the Republicans, as if it's not, you know, in a part of the system in itself. So let's talk about that, because I think that would be really important for people to understand. And that gets into the question that you were just speaking about, the question that's confronting people about what do you do? You know, what do you do right now?
Yeah, I think we have to recognize, again, this is the Republicans are a fascist party, and they are driving this assault. But they are representatives of the same system that the Democratic Party is representing. And it's the workings of this system that are actually giving initiative to this violent reassertion of patriarchy. And the Democratic Party, we just have to be honest about it, has been part of the problem since day one. They have never fought. They have never fought to defend the only just demand around this, abortion on demand and without apology. The Democratic Party ceded the moral high ground to the fascists back in Bill Clinton's day and since, when they said abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, as if there's something morally wrong with abortion. That's what rare denotes. Abortion should not be rare. There is nothing morally wrong with abortion. Fetuses are not people. Abortion is not murder, and women are not incubators. The only moral question when it comes to abortion, there is only one moral question, and it is, will women be treated as full human beings? Or will women be enslaved to forced motherhood and heaped under a mountain of shame over their sexuality and their lives? That's the only moral question. You cannot find a Democrat who will say that straight up. There's never been a major Democrat who will say that. They all concede the moral high ground. Hillary Clinton, oh, abortion is tragic. It's a difficult choice. It's the hardest choice a woman will make. Why make it harder? No. So they cede the moral high ground to these rabid, woman-hating fascists. They've ceded the legal ground and the political ground for decades. They sat back and let these fascist judges be put on the Supreme Court and be put on the federal bench at every level. They have allowed that. They have fought defensive rearguard battles under each of these attacks. Just last week in Alabama, when they were passing this vicious law that would put doctors away for 99 years, at the last minute, Alabama took out the Republicans took out the exception for rape and incest. And the Democrats made that the terms of their fight down in Alabama. They said, oh, we're really mad you're taking out the exceptions. Well, of course, that exposes the complete hatred of women behind these laws to have no exceptions even for rape and incest. But that's how the Democrats have fought this. They've fought on those details. They let the law go forward and said, but you should make exceptions. This is a defensive rearguard battle, and it's been going on for decades, and people are getting played because the Democratic Party's allegiance is not to women and to the rights of women, even though they give voice to it at times. And even though I think if you took a truth serum, many of them feel very differently about women than these fascist Republicans. But as a party, they represent the interests of the system. And to them, the Democratic Party order and stability for that system has always been more important than justice and the rights of women or the rights of black people or the rights of anybody else, the people of the world. And so the number one role that the Democratic Party has played is to corral and domesticate people's anger, to domesticate it and to lead it back into the dead end and killing embrace of this system's elections, which are always on the terms of this system and always for the purpose of keeping people from stepping out of bounds and waging the kind of struggle that could really change the direction of society and frankly cause the kind of instability that makes the Democrats freaked out. I mean, you look at this right now. Nancy Pelosi has been saying repeatedly, she's not talking about these attacks either. They're not calling people out into the streets in an emergency kind of way, saying this is the enslavement of half of humanity. Everything must come to a halt. We can't let this go forward. They're talking about, you know, Trump won't let them get infrastructure done. She's saying it's not worth it to impeach Trump. You know, these are people who are, because why? Because she says it will divide the country. Well, the country is divided. The country is deeply divided. But one side is fighting the fascists, and they're being led by their ruling class representatives, and their social base is unleashed. And the other side is being domesticated and sent to obedience school by the Democratic Party. And the truth is that we do have power to stop this. We have to get organized for an actual revolution and overthrow, which is profoundly important, because that's how you get to the root of this problem. And as Bob Avakian said, there's nothing more unrealistic than trying to reform this system into being anything close to in the interests of humanity. But as part of that, and even for people who are not with that, we need to fight the power on this. We need to be out in the streets on this. We need to be refusing to be domesticated. We need to be raising the slogan, abortion on demand and without apology. We need to be in the streets and refusing to go home as long as these laws are going forward. We need to be hooking up with the movement I'm proud to be part of, refusefascism.org, which unites people from very diverse political perspectives to be bringing forward a struggle from below in the streets, akin to what happened in South Korea a couple of years ago, akin to what happened in Armenia earlier this year, in other parts of the world where people go into the streets and mass, sustained, massive nonviolent resistance that continues over days and weeks until you create the kind of political crisis that forces those in power who today are trying to domesticate us and keep us in bounds, where our actions force them to move in a way they don't want to move right now, but to remove the Trump-Pence regime from office and to reverse the direction that society is going in some significant ways, even as it's going to take going further to an actual revolution to get to the root of the problem. I think that there is power. I was at these protests, pitiful protests. I have to say pitiful protests here in Los Angeles. A couple hundred people came out. This law was passed in Alabama. There were more people in the streets in North Ireland, if I'm not mistaken, than were in the streets here in Los Angeles protesting the Alabama law. But these tiny little protests, and people were saying, oh, if we don't vote, we're just letting it happen. That's all we have. No, it's not all you have. It's a delusion. That is not, it's actually not all, it's doing harm to think that's all you have. We have to be in the streets. This is how this, every advance has been won for the people, has been people stepping outside of bounds, breaking the rules, going in the streets, and making a demand that those in power refuse to make, and forcing them to respond to us as opposed to us tailing along after them as they capitulate time and time again.
All right, Sansara, we're going to have to wrap it up on that note. All right, Sansara, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, talk to you again soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper, and she is one of the participants in the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour.
We were talking about the fascist assault on abortion and the need to do something to oppose it. You can read her article, Will Women Be Regarded as Human Beings or Incubators? Your response to the fascist assault on abortion may well determine the answer, at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Especially where we from, where we grew up like a green thumb, like a criminal, the only thing you can become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these.
That was Lupe Fiasco with Break the Chain. Now we'll hear part of the interview I did with Dr. Willie Parker a few years back.
All right, I recently read a book that when I saw the title of it, I had to get it. And it was because it's something that I've paid a lot of attention to over the last few decades, and in particular, this book was also written by a person that I really have followed what he's been doing and admired what he's been doing and think he's actually doing work that is absolutely necessary. I consider him actually a very courageous hero in the world today. His name is Dr. Willie Parker, and his book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. You've said that actually, and I think this characterizes a lot of what you do, you said you want to make it so abortion occupies the moral high road in society, in the world today. And it's something that actually has not been done, but it's actually something that you've dedicated your life to doing. Let's talk about why.
Well, you know, I would like to make abortion be a non-issue morally. Abortion should be no more moral or immoral than a person taking care of their health. And in this case, women taking care of themselves means that they should have the right, that they are morally entitled to the right to make decisions about their health, their lives, and their body. If I say a moral high road, if we say that the opposition to abortion, it can be found on the road of morality, then I think the right to have an abortion has to be placed on that same road by allowing people who are opposed to abortion to turn it into a moral issue with no counter narrative or no alternative position on that is by default to make women taking care of themselves a moral issue and more in particular to make it an immoral issue. And I think that has allowed policymakers and people who see the world a certain way to elevate their position to one superior over the interest of a woman that she should be allowed to have in herself.
Now, one of the things that happens in all this is, which is also something you speak to right away in your book, and I thought it was very interesting that you did, you start off the book with a statement that one rarely ever hears, that as an abortion provider, I'm doing God's work. And this kind of captures a lot about your life and your role in the world. It also captures a lot of what the terms of the battle are with these people who are the anties out there who actually do want to chain women back in the prehistoric times, who basically want to make it so that women's bodies are controlled by men. They don't have any moral or actual real control over their body, or nor should they have it. So you actually have argued this as you're an abortion provider doing God's work, and that's going right up against these other people who also argue that they are doing God's work.
Sure. What it does is two things. Number one, the reality that for me, the reason I do this work, to make public my religious beliefs and my understanding in the context of the work I do, it wasn't anything strategic or tactical. It was to speak the truth about from where I live my life and where I get my values from. They are rooted in my understanding of Christianity, which for me became a conscious decision to pursue when I was 15 years old. And in that I've for so long held my beliefs as personal and most relevant to me has been why I've been most uncomfortable putting them in the public domain. But to the degree that those of us who understand the morality of a woman making her own personal decisions, to the degree that it's religious for any of us, it has to be religious for all of us. And so for me, just as people who are opposed to abortion and related to their religious or God understanding, and then they say that it prompts them to oppose abortion from a place of religious judgment. I come at my understanding about what I'm supposed to do and feel for other human beings in the context of religious compassion. Compassion is also to be found in religion, and it is simply the notion that the greatest action you can take on behalf of another person is to help them in their time of need. So people who are opposed to abortion are entitled to their opinions and even their religious beliefs about them, and so am I. If I say I'm supportive of abortion and they say that they are against abortion, we're each entitled to believe that. My notion is that with each of us having opposite notions, the public conversation around the morality of abortion should be canceled out within religious understanding. And what we should be really left with is the person who has to make the decision about whether or not to have an abortion. They should be left with what their inner voice is telling them. If one's sense of morality is personal and deeply spiritual and should govern you, then my position on abortion or the position of a person opposed to abortion should not be overbearing to a woman as she's having to make this decision.
Now, you've argued, and your training as a scientist and your actual involvement with science from the time when you were a teenager is actually really important in relation to all this, too. And it's actually, you've said that for you, not carrying out abortions and not living out the convictions you have would be a fate worse than death. Let's talk about that.
Well, what I mean by that is we all live from a place of what means most to us and being true to oneself. As a scientist and understanding and appreciating the world in an evidence and empirical-based way, the natural forces of life, the scientific, biologic realities of life, they are indifferent to what my beliefs are. You know, the sun comes up whether I believe in it or not. Gravity is a force that works whether you believe in it or not. So having that appreciation or an empirical appreciation for the world and reality sit side by side with my non-empiric appreciation for reality. And that is what we found in my spiritual understandings of things that are equally important to me, and they are deeply personal. Whereas the scientific realities aren't personal, they are there and we all stand equal before them. My religious beliefs are quite personal. And because they're personal and subjective, they may not work or be plausible or palatable for someone else. And so it's with that understanding that I hold both of my identities in an integrated way. And so it's because I understand that my beliefs are personal, I have to decide when I'm working and living in the world and interacting with other people, which frame of reference is going to be most relevant. The one when it comes to making decisions about policy, about how we are going to allocate resources, about what freedoms and liberties and restrictions we're going to make for people, those have to be related to the thing in our world and in our reality that's most objective. And the most objective things are empirically based decisions or conclusions that we reach via science. And as I say that, I repeat the words of Albert Einstein when he said that not all that matters can be counted, and not all that can be counted matters. I'm not making an argument to say that if it's not based solely in empirical understanding, that it's not important. What I am saying is the things that should govern how we make our decisions as we live in a community have to be based on the things that we all stand objective before. Religion is not one of those things, but science is.
Very important. And one of the things that you look at today, I mean, look, abortion rights, as I was reading your book and as I'm going through this and I'm thinking, abortion rights today is under an unprecedented attack. I mean, more so than ever before. And it's a battleground, and it's a very dangerous battleground for women on many different fronts. And you're in the middle of that. Let's talk about how you see that battleground.
Well, I see the ability to turn a biologic reality like the fact that 1 in 3 women in their lives will end a pregnancy. And the pregnancies that are in this country and around the world, the majority of them that are ended are ones that are unplanned and unwanted. But unplanned does not mean unwanted, because over half of unplanned pregnancies are continued. And the ones that are unwanted and unplanned are the ones that end up in abortion. So something that is that common and that is a part of the biological reality of women cannot be placed in the realm of people's preferences or likes and dislikes. Women need to have access to abortion care because we know empirically, without question, that when abortion is legal, it is safe and accessible. And when it's illegal, it is unsafe and it is very dangerous. We now have people who have grabbed power who, because ideologically, they find abortion and the biological reality that women need to end pregnancies distasteful, means that those of us who understand the importance of abortion from a safety standpoint can't stand by and watch what we know will happen if people are allowed to, because of their ideologies, they're allowed to control the health and lives of people who don't share their ideology. So it is a battleground, for lack of a better metaphor, because on both sides of this issue, people who are deeply convinced of what they think about it are motivated to defend their position. But what also makes it a battleground is that the argument, or at least the issue, is often framed in the context of what I call a false equivalency. The pro-life, pro-choice narrative has lent itself very well to people oversimplifying what the abortion decision is. And it is not one simply of pro-life and pro-choice. As a person who provides abortions, I'm pro-life. I'm pro-life of the mother. And so within the context of being against abortion or supportive of abortion, there's an element of choice in both of those sides. If you are against abortion, you can choose not to have one. And if you find yourself needing an abortion, you can choose to have one. But the pro-life, pro-choice narrative lends itself unnecessarily to battle conflict, which makes the analogy of war a very apt one.
Now, Dr. Parker, you've also said, and some of the stuff that you're talking to leads right into this, it's like very few doctors today have abortion as a specialty, even though almost every doctor is trained in one way or another to handle abortions. What's the scene here? I mean, what is it that actually has created a situation where residents train to do abortions, but the vast majority of them don't end up doing them? And overall, there's been an extremely sharp decline, as I understand it, in the numbers of abortion providers out in the world today.
Well, there certainly would have been, because of the politicizing of the issue, the domestic terrorism around the issue where people have been harmed. There have been 11 people killed. 4 of them were doctors in the context of providing abortion care. That certainly has made what I call for non-democratic dissent against abortion, even though abortion remains legal through terrorism and exploitation of regulations. Those opposed to abortion have been able to punch again above their weight, if you will. And what I mean by that, if you look at the fact that the majority of people in this country, over 50% of people approve of abortion in some form or some fashion, the fact that we now have hundreds of local restrictions on abortion, even though abortion remains legal, has resulted in this hostile environment where people who could provide abortions don't. People who are now training in abortion care, many of them have been restricted in access to abortion education because a lot of medical education occurs at the hospital and clinical level in Catholic hospitals, which often have charters and mandates prohibiting access to abortion or training around abortion. So one of the things we've been trying to do is gain more control over the regulations of medical education to require people to train in abortion care. And so there are certainly the regulations that are shifting, but there's also the kind of consumer demand. And by that, I mean young people who are entering into medicine who are aware of the loss of access. They are actually seeking medical education that will provide them with the training to provide abortion. So organizations like Medical Students for Choice at the medical school level, women's studies and reproductive rights and reproductive justice or interest groups at the college level are informing people of abortion access challenges, and those people are aspiring to enter into medicine with the intent of becoming abortion providers. You have people who are pursuing education as non-physicians who are fighting for the right to be able to provide abortions, like nurse practitioners, midwives, and the like. So there's a consumer demand, but it's been thwarted in large part that even as abortion remains legal, again, domestic terrorism around people being harmed and injured, perpetually harassed and marginalized in their choice of a medical career, that is kind of cowering people away from providing the care. But I think that that's changing.
Now, what about the question, though, that also comes up a lot in relation to if women can't find somebody to actually give them an abortion, if they can't find a doctor or a clinic or something, or they can't afford it or whatever, they oftentimes turn to do-it-yourself abortions. And that seems to be a major plague in the world today, and directly a product of the kind of oppression that you're talking about coming down around women. Let's talk about that.
Well, actually, to your point, the majority of abortions that happen today in the world happen under unsafe circumstances, because the majority of them happen in places around the world, especially developing countries that have been controlled by people with fundamentalist religious understanding or very patriarchal ones. In those places, abortion is illegal, and in those places, that's where we see the greatest number of mortalities related to abortion. The mortalities come from the reality that I wish people simply understand that a woman or a person who's pregnant and they don't want to be, when they are resolved to not be pregnant, they will do whatever they need to do to end that pregnancy, such that a woman will choose illegal or unsafe abortion to end the pregnancy versus acquiescing to the reality of having a safe, legal pregnancy. So it's to say that women will do whatever they need to do. They will choose something that's potentially life-threatening if it's going to allow them to accomplish their reproductive goal, even when they could simply acquiesce and do something that would be safer. So women are committed to achieving their reproductive goals and not having their lives controlled by the interest of others. And so what that means is when we outlaw abortion, we don't make it less frequent. We make it less safe. The reality is that before Roe and after Roe, the number of abortions were approximately the same. What was different is the number of women who died from abortion. Deaths from abortions in this country became virtually nil from unsafe abortions. There's an intrinsic risk to every procedure, no matter how skilled the person is or no matter how optimal the circumstances are. People sometimes die. When you see a person goes in for a routine tonsillectomy and they don't wake up, there's an intrinsic risk with every procedure. But we know that when abortion is safe and is legal, that it is so safe that women rarely die from abortion. But yet when it's illegal and women are taking desperate measures, abortion becomes extremely risky. And the implications go beyond just a woman losing her life. Many women who have abortions are already parents, so that means children become orphans. Women have abortions are already partnered. That means that spouses or lovers lose a partner. And so there's an impact as a society. If those people were working, we lose people who can contribute. So there's losses on multiple levels when we lose sight of the fact that simply outlawing abortions doesn't make them less frequent. It only makes them less safe.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Willie Parker. And we're talking about his book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And Dr. Parker is one of the courageous heroes in the world today who has stood up against the attack on abortion rights and for the recognition of women as full human beings. Now, you've argued that there is an analogy between putting limits on women's reproductive rights and slavery.
Yes, I know that sounds like bombast in a country that has a horrendous legacy of slavery and racism. And it sounds like bombast, especially when we live in a country that has that legacy, but is unwilling to talk about race in a meaningful way. But all of us have some form of reference with slavery. Even the most sanitized notions of slavery, people understand that people were owned by other human beings and that those people's lives and wills and activities were controlled by the interests of other people. I can't think of a more apt or more direct analogy to denying a woman access to control over her body. So even for people who don't come from a legacy of slavery, in order to understand what it means when a woman cannot make her own reproductive health decisions, you simply need to understand that when captured Africans were under the control of people who economically used their labor for their own benefit and took away the self-determination of those people, that is no different from us reducing women to breeders when we say that they cannot control their reproduction and they are forced to continue pregnancies that they never wanted or that the ones that they wanted but that became dangerous for them to continue. I know that, again, perspective and proportion have to come into play, but if one understands the degree to which folk were controlled, then one would see that there is a sense of proportionality to making that assertion.
Now, one of the things, and this is a fairly heavy thing because it actually plays out all the time, or it's in the background, actually more in the foreground these days, because something that people never really thought about very much, even though it's been going on for a while, and it's especially increased over the last couple of decades, is the danger to doctors who decide that they are, in fact, no matter what, they are going to provide abortions to women who need them. And there's been an occasional spurt here and there of doctors being killed, doctors and people that work in abortion clinics being killed. And it comes out now, even in terms of when places are surrounded, like you talk in your book about when you go to work every morning, you have to get out and you have to wonder in your own head what's going to happen between getting out of the car and getting to the door of the office of the abortion clinic. You know, and this whole idea that your life can be taken by someone who is so deeply opposed to the humanity of women that they're going to stop the one person that they think is actually ruining the lives of women, which is you, the doctor. And you said you have no desire to die prematurely, which, again, as I'm saying, is a real threat. But you're more intent on avoiding a death of spirit than avoiding harm for doing abortions. I thought that was something really important for people to consider and to hear your thoughts on.
You know, they say that you can't be brave unless you're scared. And I am like anybody else. I have value for life. And I know that sounds provocative to people who reduce life to an event by saying that life begins at conception and they fancy that a developing pregnancy is a person. But I am not any different from anybody else in that regard. Dr. King said that as well when he says, like anybody else, I want to live a long life. It has its place. But he says, if a person has been found something that they live for to the point that in their pursuit of it, they might be injured fatally, that person is not fit to live. And he said, if you at 35 become afraid to do what you know is right in your heart, and you live another 65 years, when you finally start breathing, it's just a belated announcement of something that's already occurred. So I'm more, as you said, I decided that I can live with the fact that someone might try and harm me for doing what I know is the right thing. I don't know that I could live with myself if I had to face on a daily basis that I consciously became afraid to do what I knew was the right thing to do simply because someone threatened me. I have no desire to die prematurely, but the other way that I manage that risk and that possibility is to understand that we all have to choose what we live for and not pay so much attention to what we might die from, because we're all going to die. You know, I'm no more detached to being here. This is all I know. We can speculate about what's after, if there is an after, and that's what comes in the domain of our religious understanding. But when it comes to dealing with the reality every day, we all have to decide what counts. And Dr. King said that the most important question that you will have to ask yourself at the end of your life, or that someone may ask of you, is what did you do for others? It's not going to be whether or not you had a degree or how much money you had. It's what did you do for others? And to me, that's a very central principle for my life. In order for my life to have meaning and purpose and to count in the way that I want it to, I simply have decided that the way that I've chosen to serve women gives my life the meaning and the purpose that lets me get up every day and be fully aware that someone might be willing to harm me. But as long as I continue to focus on the rightness of what I do and who it helps, then I don't spend time worrying about how I might die.
Now, as I was going through your book and then thinking about this and reading some other things, I kept coming back to this point. On the one hand, you have all the assaults on the doctors and all the assaults on the right of women to have abortion that are out there in the public sphere, and they're all being pushed out. And you see it, you know, if you pay any attention to it, you see the hordes of anti-abortionists, people who are actually out there really trying to take women back to the Middle Ages or to keep women in their place and deny their humanity and all their rights as a human being. And you actually, at the same time, have had to confront not only those kinds of attacks, but you've also had to confront the reality that there's a tsunami of regulations that have been poured out to actually make it almost impossible for you to actually do the work in any kind of way where you can just walk in and do your work and know that you're doing good and deal with it. You have a whole pile of just this, you know, barrel of regulations that are hitting you from every day, from every angle. And I know you were in the movie Trapped, which was a very powerful movie, and it actually spoke to some of this, how this tsunami of regulations is really meant to, one, hit at the doctors, but also to sort of make it so that there's, to try and seal off the abortion clinics and the people willing to do abortions from the women who need them.
Yes, it's hyper-regulation, it's abuse of regulatory authority. Each state has a Department of Health, and that Department of Health is charged with protecting the health and well-being of its citizens. And it's interesting to me that ideologically some people have chosen to grant citizenship to unborn pregnancies at the expense of the women carrying those pregnancies. And so while they've not been able to successfully overthrow the law of the land in terms of the Roe decision, although it feels to me like we're on a road to make that happen, in the absence of that, in the past 44 years, what they've done is functionally gutted the provisions of Roe, that the thing that stands between states carrying out their own agendas around reproductive rights, the thing that stands between that and women's access has been that Roe says that in the first trimester, nobody can outlaw abortion. But now you have states that said, okay, if we can't outlaw the abortion, we're going to make you wait as long as possible because we're going to create some notion that you, when you make your decision, you need more time to make it. We're not going to provide funding that would support poor women to have the same access to services that women of means would have. We're going to have regulations around how wide the halls can be or how many bathrooms are there, various ways in which you can create regulations that appear to have something to do with safety, but in no way at all do they have any bearing on the content of abortion care. So it's been an abuse of regulatory authority to, in essence, legitimize the idealized position of folk who are against abortion. You can't walk into a state house and say, the Lord told me that abortion is evil, so as a state, we shouldn't do it. But you can walk in and say that fetuses are babies and we have a compelling interest in the state to protect the life of all of our citizens, and we have a compelling interest to protect the life of the women, even though we know without a doubt, incontrovertibly via evidence and studies, that abortion is one of the safest, most common procedures. And there's no question that when women have access to safe abortion, their lives are protected and preserved. So some people say that when you live in a society, there can be an inverse correlation between the presence of justice and the number of laws. Or in other words, when you live in a just society, you don't need laws to make people conform to justice. A just society, people will willingly participate and abide by the rules of that society. So the injustice of denying women access to abortion is often perpetrated paradoxically by increasing laws that pretend to create justice when they do anything but.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor and Dr. Willie Parker. And thanks to my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
Blue-eyed son, oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in 7 sad forests.